work on what's important for you.
Hi, that was the highest my voice has ever gone. Welcome back to the Wild Business Growth Podcast. This is your place to hear from a new entrepreneur every single Wednesday morning who's turning wild ideas into wild growth. I'm your host, Max Brandstetter, founder and podcast producer at Max Podcasting, and you can email me at max@maxpodcasting.com to save time with your high-quality podcast. This is episode 270 Ocho, and one of these days I'll be able to say eight without Ocho, but I think Ocho is just such a cool-sounding word. And today's guest is Idakin Tonk. Idakin is the founder and CEO of Jotform, the super popular online form builder that you've probably used even if you didn't know you were using it. He has grown Jotform from a small company with a product that he was giving away for free to 20 million users, several hundred employees around the world. And in this episode, we talk how he did that, his rule. He's like the king of rules. Awesome rules on productivity, hiring, and the in and on the business type thing. Tips from his Wall Street Journal bestseller, Automate Your Busy Work. And lessons for motivation from Michael Jordan. He's like a basketball player or something. It is I, Idakin. Enjoy the show. Alrighty, we are here with Idakin Tonk, a name that I've been practicing since birth. But no, really excited. Idakin, the founder and CEO of Jotform, really, really cool company with, I would say, just a couple customers and couple employees that you've built up over the years. But so excited to dig into it today. Idakin, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on your show, Max.
Of course. And you pronounce Max correctly as well. So we're just on fire to start. But before we get to the Jotform story, which really, really cool. You know, this whole interview could just be me saying your company is cool. And you'd be like, yeah, it is cool. No, but in college, you studied computer science or comp sci, as the cool kids say. I'm somebody who has a basic understanding of what computer science is, but like very basic. I have no idea what those classes are like, what you studied, what it actually is involved back then. What do you think is the most common misconception that people have about computer science just when they hear the term?
I think one of the things that is different in computer science compared to other engineering departments, usually when you become an engineer, you always have this creativity, but you are usually like building similar things, right? That's why you have all these certifications and like, you know, you're building a bridge, right? You might be building a different kind of bridge, but it's well established. But in computer science, like every time you do something, it's new. And every year you have new technologies. It's all changing. But when you study in the school, you learn the algorithms, you learn the basics. That background actually helps you a lot. But you know, when you study computer science, when you actually get out of the door, you know nothing. Like when you start your job, you start from zero. I actually had my own products while I was studying in school. I had my open source products. So I learned before I graduated. So it was kind of easier for me to find a job. And, you know, the first day I started a job, I already knew the technologies. But in most cases, people who graduate, they have to start from scratch to learn new stuff because the technology is changing so much every year. And the schools are actually kind of falling behind. I mean, they're teaching the basics. They're teaching the general stuff that doesn't change much as opposed to the latest technologies. So it also makes sense to keep it that way.
It's fascinating when you look at it across different industries. Like I'm somebody who studied business. I studied marketing and entrepreneurship, and especially in the marketing space, like, you know, like I was studying these things in the early 2010s, we'll call it. And just think how much marketing has changed in the past 10 or 15 years. And so I can only imagine like
how much, you know, computers and technology and coding and like everything in that space has changed as well. It's like as a university, you really have to stay nimble and agile in order to, you know, stay at the leading edge of that. But for you, how did you become interested in just something involving computers or computer science in the first place?
Actually, that's an interesting story. Growing up in Turkey, this is like the end of 80s, so I'm getting old.
Oh, you take that back.
Middle school, it's like, I don't know, 89 or 90, 1990, right? I'm in the middle school. I don't have a computer at home, like, but there was like a computer room in the high school I went, the middle school I went. And there was actually like these weekend classes, right? If you remember those times, like you wouldn't want to go back to school, right? Over the weekend. But I would actually dream about going to that, taking that class over the weekend class. During the weekdays, I would dream about like the weekend comes and I actually go back to school. And actually, like we had these basic PCs, Amiga computers, and like we were like, you know, programming basic and simple, you know, programming. But it excited me so much that every week I was thinking about the weekend. I wasn't thinking about going outside, but I was thinking about going back to the school. And that passion stayed with me. And I didn't have a computer while I was in high school. When I actually went to college, now, you know, I could actually start doing that. And I was so excited about that. Like, you know, I was building my own open source products and, you know, releasing them by the time I was studying in the university.
Can you explain the feeling you have when you got to use and tinker with a computer for the first time?
Like I could do anything. I also discovered something about myself. I discovered that I'm a product person. And still today, I feel like I'm a product person. What I mean by a product person is like creating a product from scratch, like out of nothing, seeing other people use that product. It just gave me like so much tremendous enjoyment. Even when I was like creating a game when I was in middle school and sharing it with others, with like a single person. And today, JotForm is being used by millions of people. Of course, like I created the first version. Now, like I haven't been writing code for the last 5 to 10 years, probably, but I'm still the product person. So I don't have to actually be writing the code. I enjoy being part of the creation of that product and seeing people use the product. And that just stayed with me since that time, since like, I don't know how many years, like 30 plus years.
You didn't know how much math you're going to have to do on this podcast. I think it through the years. I should have told you to bring a microphone, headphones, and a calculator. Let's get to that JotForm story. So as we hinted at, just incredible company, you know, working with some of the biggest, you know, brands and so millions of customers. First of all, on that note, like to this day, do you have to pinch yourself when people say that you have 20 million customers?
Yeah, it's always exciting to say that. But, you know, no matter like if we have 20 million users or 20 users, I think it's important to, you know, create value for our users. And that really excites me. This story of JotForm actually starts right out of college. I started working for this media company in New York. And I was a developer for 5 years there. As a media company, I was actually helping all these editors. Like we had over 100 websites. And I was helping all these editors with their form needs. Like they needed, you know, questionnaires. They were running contests. They needed contact forms, like payment forms, you know, poll surveys, all kinds of forms. And I was kind of like looking for a solution because like I was kind of like doing the same thing all over, all the time. Like I searched for a solution, like maybe someone actually made a product that can actually create the forms, but I couldn't find one. And that's when I knew that like this could be a good idea when I quit my job to start my business. And that's what I did in 2005 summer. I quit my job. I started working on JotForm. And 2006, February, I released the first version of JotForm. And I think all that experience gained because I was helping so many editors with so many forms gave me so much experience about like what kind of needs people have. Out of the gate, people actually started using it. People, you know, started loving it. Of course, the numbers weren't this big, but even from the day one, like I started receiving registrations. Like I remember I was receiving like 20 to 50 signups per day, even like 2006. And one of the reasons was that I really wanted to see people use this product. I actually gave it away for free. Like it was all free during the first year. Like there was no like paid version. And I wanted to get feedback. I wanted to make sure that everything is good. And that actually helped me like fix all the missing features, make sure the product is ready for when people need to use it for real. And people were actually using it for real. But a year after that, in 2007, I released the paid version. And right away, I released the paid version. At that time, I had like 15,000 free users, and 500 of them signed up for the paid version. You know, that proved to me that this is a real business and this is going to be a successful business, even though it was like $9 a month. So at that time, like, you know, 500 customers, $9 a month, it was only $4,500 a month that I was earning. But that was a proof for me that this is going to be a successful business. And then the rest is history. It's been 18 years. It's been a long time. You know, I still enjoy working on JotForm. One thing that's different about JotForm is it's completely bootstrapped. I never received any funding, and I never received any investments, no debt. I had been going just by the funds from customers, and I've been growing slowly. So the first year, it was me alone. 2006 September, I hired my first employee. 2007, I hired my second employee. And I had this rule that I would only hire an employee if I have like 1 year salary for all my employees in the bank. That's actually defined my growth. Some years I would just hire an additional employee, and then some years I could hire 5 or 10 employees. So this actually allowed me to not take any risks, because I know that, you know, even if the people stopped using JotForm, I would still have the funds to, you know, pay my employees for a year. That gave me the confidence to, you know, continue growing without going too fast. Or I also didn't want to go too slow, because going too slow is also bad, because I wanted to reinvest in my business. I remember, like, you know, I didn't even have a car. Like my employees would actually had a car, and I would actually walk to a bus station. And I remember, like, there is a blizzard, and I'm walking to the bus station, and I actually had this great feeling that, you know, this is actually good, because I'm investing everything in the business. I'm not actually spending any funds on something else. And that actually, you know, made me feel better about myself, made me feel good about myself. That was before I had a family, of course. Like, you know, once I had a family, I actually taken it more, you know, like started having comfortable things, having a comfortable, you know, car and house. Until I had that, like, I kept it very, very tight, and I invested everything in my business.
Yeah, it's a beautiful philosophy. I remember back in the day seeing you wait outside in line for the bus stop. I really should have picked you up. No, but I love many aspects about you. What you just said, one of them that sticks out to me is your philosophy. If I could pronounce it, your philosophy on not hiring that next employee until you like are sure you have, you know, enough money in the bank for everybody's salary for a year. Because I think that's something so many business owners struggle with is, well, first of all, when you take that first jump to hire your first employee, and then beyond that, when do you know when's the right time to grow your team? And I think like there's a great debate about like, should you wait till you have X amount in the bank, or should you hire and kind of like bet on yourself and your team to make that revenue you know, X-fold times. And it's a bit of a gamble there. How did that idea crystallize for you that let's make sure like we have this amount in the bank before we truly expand this to more and more team members?
People believe that entrepreneurs are these like big risk takers. They play poker. I'm terrible at poker. Terrible bluffer. I'm a terrible risk taker. Because of that, because I'm really bad at risk taking, I need to make sure that I'm not overextending myself. I'm not overhiring. Another rule I have is I will always have 25% margin on my business. Even today, I look at that. Like, I look at the cash earnings. Now that we are actually switched to accrual accounting, it's harder, but I look at the cash revenues, and then I look at our expenses, and I want to make sure that at the end of the year, I have that 25%. I'm spending 25% less than I earn. As long as I follow that, I follow the rule that, you know, I should have a one-year salary for all my employees. I think those two rules make sure that you don't take any risks. 18 years in business, and we never did a layoff. We did hiring freezes, usually short time, like 3 months, 6 months. Usually happened because, like, you know, we really had a good recruiting team, and then, you know, we were growing fast. And then, okay, we said, okay, we grow too fast. Like, let's hire less a little bit. But we never did a layoff, and I'm very proud of that. And when I see our competitors, like, you know, they are laying off, like making one of our competitors actually laid off like 60% of their employees. Seeing all those things, of course, I don't want to, you know, have bad wishes about all those people who lost their jobs. But I feel like, you know, this not being a risk taker is a good thing, because that's the other thing that I care about. Like, people, employees staying for a long time. Create a work environment that allows people to actually stay a long time. Stay for 5 or 10 years, as opposed to, like, you know, coming for a year or two and leaving. Make sure that we have like good benefits, good work environment. We care so much about the office spaces and make sure that we have good office space. Like, we have 7 offices around the world, and the biggest office is in Turkey, and we also have headquarters in San Francisco. But like, we work with like the good interior designers and make sure that like when people come to the office, like they feel they're proud of the company they work for. That helps people feel like, you know, being part of a successful, good company.
Yeah, you're saying people don't want to work in an ugly, dirty environment. That's very controversial. No, but I think that's another aspect that is pretty remarkable is how you've gone from, you know, one employee at one location to 7 locations around the world. And I mean, we're talking like very different time zones. How has your approach as, you know, CEO and business owner changed since you started to branch into more and more offices and might I say beautifully interior designed offices?
Yeah. So this is actually a big question now. Like, should you work from the office or should you work remotely, right? We moved to working from home when the pandemic hit. We were actually very productive. I think we stayed at home until like September 2021, I think. But the problem was the people we hired, like the people who joined the team new or people who are just new graduates, it was very hard for them. Like, it was very hard for us to get them be part of our culture. I think one day maybe remote is going to be as good as working from the office, but I think we are far away from that. But this is also about the way we work in the office. Like, we don't have an open office. Like, I'm definitely against open offices. Like, what we have is like, we have small teams. Every team actually have their own offices. And in their offices, like, they have this, you know, whiteboard and their door closed, and you know, and they're working on a single project together whole day, and they have independence. So because we have that structure, it actually works for us. But I also understand that people who work in the open offices, they would prefer working from home. And this approach actually worked for us. And I think the main reason we went back to the offices was like not being able to really engage, you know, all these new people who are joining the company, engage all the junior employees. Because people who were working really well before, when they moved to home, they were actually performing as well, and they did a good job. But your original question was like, how did I decide to have beautiful offices? I mean, in the beginning, our offices weren't that good. I have to admit, they were. As we have grown more, I saw the importance of, like, we are spending so much time in the office, having all these conversations about the product. For example, one of the things is like making sure that you know, you have food in the office, free food, free drinks. That's good because now we can actually eat together if you want to, and then we can continue discussions about our product. I think that also has to do with being a single product company. Everybody is thinking about the same things. Everybody is thinking about how to make JotForm great. And that allows us to, like, when we talk to each other, talk about JotForm. And having a good office environment that actually people want to stay there. Like, people don't want to go. You know, comfortable chairs, sitting areas, you know, the food and drinks, free foods and drinks. And all those things actually kind of make the office environment better. And in the early years, I guess, like, I was also single and I was spending so much time in the office, more time in the office, that, you know, I cared about having good office spaces.
Well, you had me at food. I'm all for anything food. I think I'm coming to visit right after this. No, it's really nice that you provide those things. And when you think about JotForm, that's one huge change, is the offices, in addition to working from home. But the amount of users that's changed is huge, as you mentioned. The company and actually what you deliver, I'm sure, has changed. How has that changed since, like, that first year when you had only free users? I want to make sure that came through clear. I'm saying free users, not three users. You had a lot more than three users. But when you had users that weren't paying for JotForm yet, what sort of offering did you have? Like, was that in any way similar to what you provide as a company today?
Not at all. Like, you know, I'm a product person. I see myself as a product person because I care so much about our product. In the beginning, like, we were learning so much from our users, but our product was much smaller. And my focus was always, you know, making sure that we onboard our users well. I think that's really important. Of course, this is a form builder. People create forms with JotForm. So making sure that our form builder is well was, like, has always been my top priority. And we have accomplished that by, like, rewriting our form builder, like, four times over the years. In software, it takes 10 years to create a great product. Joel Spolsky actually has a blog post about that. That's, like, one of my favorite articles. And it takes 10 years to create a good product because just, like, figuring out what users need, figuring out where you need to expand your product, where you need to simplify, like, where they are failing. Like, all those things take time, and you have to, you know, rewrite your product, add some new features to it. You cannot just have 100 people and then reduce that amount to, like, from, like, 10 years to one, because it's about learning. It's about learning from your users. For example, in the early days, I didn't know about, like, doing things like user testing, getting people to use your product and watching them how they use your product and learning from that. I didn't know about, like, user interviewing, user research, like interviewing people, finding out how they use your product and what kind of missing things they see. But I had some ideas. Like, I actually had, like, this open forum. I provided support, publicly open forum. So people could see that when someone wrote something, like, okay, this is broken. And I would answer, okay, fixed now. Like, the next day, I would say, it's fixed now. Or the same day, I would say, it's fixed now. Or if someone had an idea, others would come in and then they would add their opinions. This kind of open environment, people actually, even though this is a new product, people trusted it because they knew that I was there all the time. Like, I was actually taking care of business. And product was improving every day. They could see that from my forum posts. And we kept that. We still have, like, you can actually go to JotForm and you can see, by default, it's private because we don't, you know, sometimes people will accidentally put, like, private stuff in their support questions. but you can actually make it public and many people actually, and you can see like what kind of problems people have, and that actually builds confidence as well. As a growth that also helps with SEO as well, because you know people who are writing those things, also other people are searching for them, and then they will find our forum threads. And one of the things we did was, in addition to the form builder, like rewriting it four times over the first 10 years, one of the things we did was we discovered that people actually had a journey, and the first step of the journey started with a form. So you fill out a form, not because you want to just like, you know, fill out a form. You have a purpose, right? You want to apply for something. You want to register for something. You want to request something. You want to contact someone. But that's just the first step. And we were just helping people with the first step, just with the forms. And then they were handling the rest, like using like Excel or email or whatever they were using. So we decided, okay, this is a journey and the forms are the first step. What if we start helping them rest of the journey? We actually built our own spreadsheet product that's called JotForm Tables. We created this inbox product. We created features like JotForm Approvals, JotForm PDF Editor, which is like a document generation product, JotForm Sign, an e-signature product, JotForm Apps, where you can actually build apps, where you can install this, you know, you can put your forms in an app and then you can install them on your mobile phone. And then when you need to access a form, you can access it from there. So we actually started taking care of all those different kinds of needs people have. This actually also helped me as a product guy because, you know, it kind of gets boring just working on the same product for a long time. But once we actually started discovering all these other product needs people have and started building these additional products, that also helped me with these craving for building new products. This is so much fun for me. And even though it's been 18 years, I still enjoy working on our product every day.
I saw you getting out that calculator there with the 18 years, but yeah, you stumbled on something that we actually spoke about with a previous guest, episode 276, Liz Georgie from Suna. She spoke about that same thing where some of the best brands today, and most of the best brands that are providing something, well, everybody's providing something, but that do their value prop the best. They have like their core product that they start with, and then over time are able to add on more and more layers to that product or separate products that complement it. And of course, it's all revenue streams as well, but also it, as a customer, that totally strengthens your connection with the brand. It's really cool to hear about and see how you've innovated with JotForm. And I'm glad to hear that you're having fun with the new things as well, because 18 years without having fun would not be good for any founder. On that note of, I keep going back to being astounded by how many users you have and how big your team has grown over the years. Just high level, like for any business, what is the one thing that you need to get right in order to scale to the point of having potentially millions of users or customers one day?
I would say it's a business model. Because if you have the wrong business model, even if you have the greatest product in the world, that you're not going to be able to grow. It's just, you're just going to be stuck. I mean, every company kind of have a different kind of bottlenecks. I think it's all about discovering these bottlenecks, solving these bottlenecks and improving your growth. So I have this rule that I call 50-50 rule. Usually like when I advise founders, I will talk about that. And the 50-50 rule is like, as a founder, especially in the first days, but this also applies even 10 years after you started your company. As a founder, you should make sure that you spend in half of your time with your product or service, and half of your time with your growth and marketing. And they also depend on each other. Right? If you are weak in one area, the other area will also stumble. Because let's say you are making a great product, but you don't know marketing. You have no traffic on your website. You have no users. You have no customers. And because of that, you are not getting any feedback on your product. People are not telling you like what you need to do next, like how they use your product. You have no idea what's going on. You could build this way for years and years, and you're just going to overbuild. It's a terrible path many founders will take. Today, even today, like when we actually need to like release a new product or a new MVP of a new product or a new feature, what we are going to do is like we are going to just quickly create an MVP, and then we are going to release it to like 100 users or 1,000 users, a small number of users. And then we see if people use it, if they get value, if they get confused, what kind of feedback they have. So we learn from those information, and then we gradually increase the number of people who use that part. The same way, in the early days, you have to have all these people who are using your product. If you have a good product, but no one is using it, you have to work on the growth. So you focus on your growth, you focus on your marketing, you bring more traffic to your website or whatever. Like if you're a mobile app, you bring more traffic to your, you know, app store listing. Whatever you do, you bring more traffic. And then once you have more traffic, now you look at all those people who are using your product. If they are staying, if they are activating, can you onboard them? Do you have any problems with onboarding them, or are you losing them at the first step, or you are onboarding them well, but they don't stay a long time, like they just stay 2 months, you have a big churn problem. So next you focus on that part, right? If your product is confusing, if your product is not really answering the problems your customers have, even if you have a good growth and marketing, those people you bring are just going to churn out, or they are not going to even onboard because you have a confusing product. And that's actually one of the reasons we actually rewrote our form builder 4 times. And because every time we rewrote, we believe that, okay, this is perfect. Like everyone can figure it out. And we figured out that, no, it's actually, you know, still there are a lot of people who cannot figure out, because every time we actually increase the number of people who can use it, but people are busy. They are doing so much stuff at the same time. You know, they will start using JotForm on one tab, and then someone will call them, and then they will open a new tab, and that's it. They will forget about it. There is just so many things that can happen. You want to make sure that you engage them. You don't get them confused. You don't get them up. So one of the things we see when we watch like usability testing is, okay, here is a user. You give them a task. Okay, build a survey for this and something like that, right? And the user is coming to JotForm, building the things. And everything is going perfectly. Like they do like 20 things correctly. But then they are trying to do one additional task. But they couldn't figure out. They get confused. And what we see is that even a single roadblock can just make people impatient, and they will just say, I cannot figure this out. This is very confusing. And they will just quit. It's very important to really figure out where you have those bottlenecks and fix them, either product or marketing. This is like a constant cycle. You work on one part, and then you get really good at one part, and then the other part is kind of weak. Now you go back and work on the other part. And this is a cycle that works. But the business model is important, because even if you are building a good product, if you cannot actually snowball your revenues, if you cannot increase your revenues, you will not be able to grow your team. And the fourth version of the form builder we rewrote, we were able to do a good job, because I was able to hire all these amazing designers. I was able to hire all these great developers. And I was able to build this great team that was able to, you know, they were able to accomplish that. And the technology change allowed us to be, you know, more flexible as well. So you need resources to be able to hire good people. And that depends on your business model.
Speaking of models, Michael Scott often called Ryan Howard a model in The Office. And that very Ryan Howard, aka BJ Novak, is the closing keynote speaker at CEX. At CEX Content Entrepreneur Expo, which takes place May 5th through 7th, 2024, in my hometown and favorite city of Cleveland, Ohio. If you are interested in attending and seeing BJ, as well as the top speakers in the content entrepreneur space that will teach you a ton about launching and growing a content entrepreneur business, career, whatever you want to call it, Use the coupon code MAX100 to save $100 off the in-person ticket price. And that is because Max Podcasting is a media partner for CEX. That's promo code MAX100. That is at cex.events. Now, let's alliterate.
So you segued swimmingly, because one of the other areas that I know you're very profound on and that I want to hit on is productivity. And I think the whole in the business, on the business thing that everybody struggles with ties closely to productivity. And you, not, I'm not calling you a productivity expert or anything, but you did write a whole book that kind of dives into that, Automate Your Busy Work. So really, really cool stuff all around. What, you know, in addition to that 50-50 rule that you spoke of, what's another, I guess, philosophy on productivity that you have that could greatly benefit other entrepreneurs out there?
The original story for the book is like many years before I wrote the book. It was early days of JotForm, like maybe like 4 or 5 years into JotForm. We are still a small team, like 5 to 10 people. But like I was so busy. I was like doing everything. I was doing support. I was doing accounting, legal, HR, ordering supplies for the kitchen in the office. On top of all that stuff, I was spending half of my day on email and other half, you know, customer support. So I was like working like 2 person. The problem is I wasn't actually working on the important things. I wasn't spending so much time on my product, improving my product. I wasn't working on things that I enjoy. I had just so much busy work. And right at this moment, something else happened. Google came out with a competing product. Google Forms came out. So now, on top of all that, now I had to compete with Google. Yeah, David and Goliath story, right?
Well, it's easy. It's got to be really easy to compete with Google, right? Like they're not well known. They're not anybody's homepage or anything. So
yeah, no. You know, I started thinking about like how can I solve this, and I decided, okay, this is not going well. I need to start changing something. I decided, okay, I was a developer and I'm a, you know, I studied computer science, right? So I should be able to write code. I should be able to automate things. And I started looking into automation and I figured out like, I didn't even have to like write code. Like there are many automation tools that you could use and there are many things you can do to automate things. You just have to take the time. You just have to, you know, take the time. If you spend a day for automations, you can gain like a year of, you know, work that way. Like there's just like so many opportunities. So I started with that and I automated many things. I delegated many things. Like the amount of time I was spending with emails, I was able to reduce that from like 6 hours to like 2 hours because of the way I was using my inbox. Like I was, you know, I didn't do like inbox zero. I didn't do like really prioritize things, build my own automation systems around emails. And I did all that. I also started delegating more. I hired people from Upwork to help me with the support, because at this point I was still the only support person as well. Like I was answering customer support questions, which was really nice. I was learning so much, but it was too much. And these learnings kind of shaped the way we did things. You know, using automation as much as possible became like having an automation first mindset became a default for me. And I started even using the ideas within the product. How can I help people automate things? Like when people receive a form, maybe they need to create like a PDF document, right? From the data they receive on the form. How can we automate that? How can we automate their approval system? All those ideas also help me with the product and also with the way our team work. Like, you know, how can we like streamline our product development or like, how we launch our product, how we, you know, make our product live to our users, things like that. That automation first mindset helped me become successful. Last year, I released that book, The Automate Your Busy Work, and it became a Wall Street Journal bestseller.
Yeah. Congrats on that. I gave you a congrats and a voice crack at the same time. So that's an extra congrats.
All these things that I learned, I shared in the book. automate your busy work. So one of the things is having this automation first mindset. I think the first principle is clarify your priorities. And I recommend doing this basically time audit. So you create this spreadsheet. Every hour, you make a note of how you spend that hour. And at the end of the week, you total them up, and then you know what you did during that week. For me, I was like, 20, 30 hours doing customer support, 40 hours maybe, doing emails, things like that. Once you actually have that total, you ask yourself two questions. What should I spend my time on, and what shouldn't I spend my time on? Because the goal of automation or delegation or like saving time is not to actually work less. I think the goal is prioritization. The goal is to be able to work on important things as opposed to things that feel like they are urgent or time sensitive. When you ask those questions like what should I spend my time on and what shouldn't I spend my time on, you kind of see where you are spending your time on currently and things that are actually taking your time. They're not just taking your time. If you don't enjoy them, they are also sucking your energy. They are sucking your motivation. Like you start burning out. And like all those creative ideas you could have, because you are busy with the busy work, like you use that energy. You use your best time of the day, like whatever time is best for you. If you are spending that time with, checking emails, like doing busy work, ordering supplies, you just lost that hours and you cannot replace that. Like, if that's the morning time for you, you cannot, go in the afternoon and become creative because you already used up those important hours of your day. Clarifying your priorities, yeah, and then automating those things are the first principle. The second principle is harness impatience and laziness. If you keep doing all this busy work, if you keep doing the same things again and again, you kind of need to feel like you enough is enough. Like, okay, I'm not going to do this like anymore. Like, I'm going to find a solution so that I can automate this thing. And Bill Gates actually has a great quote. He says that I would always hire a lazy person to do a hard job because that person would find an easy way to do it. It's about harnessing impatience and laziness. And the third principle is you need to make time to save time. You need to spend the time researching all the available products, understand how you spend your time, like what kind of things take your time, what kind of things are constantly sending you notifications, or like if you have to context switch all the time, if you have to change what you are doing all the time, that's like you are just losing so much time because of the context switch. You need to find those things and then you need to find solutions that can actually help you with automating those things. And that requires spending time doing research. It's just easy to do something, right? I can just do this. I've been always doing this, right? You can just say that. But the problem is if you do that, you're not just spending that time on that thing, but you will also spend that time on that thing tomorrow, the next day, the next week. So, if you spend that time really like sharpening the saw, finding an automation, that's going to help you in the long term. So you will save like so much time in the long term. In this book, I also talk about the automation flywheel. It's about dividing and conquering your work, your busy work, designing and implementing your automations, and then building your system. So the goal is to become, instead of being an individual contributor of your work, to becoming a manager of your systems and your automations. And this requires that instead of doing things, you're actually managing them. This requires actually designing, understanding your workflows, the way you work. Because usually like the work we do are not just like one task, like one step. They are workflows. So I need to send an email to someone. I need to schedule something. I need to get an answer from a customer. So you have to do all these things. But, there is also products like Calendly that can actually save you like so much time doing all that busy work. And then like it's just it's stressful, it's busy work, it's unnecessary. I just shared with you my calendar, right? And you found the best time for you, and then that's it. We were able to meet up, and just there's no like 10 emails, just to schedule time, find a good time for us. So it's about like finding automations for your workflows. And then once you do that, you have your systems, you start thinking like a manager. Instead of thinking like an individual contributor, you start thinking like you are the manager of your systems, you are the manager of your automations. What does a good manager do? A good manager actually maybe delegates, but checks on them as well. Like you need to check what's going on. You need to be aware of your automations, if they're working well. Be aware of your KPIs, key performance indicators of your automations. So it feels like more work, right? But the thing is, like, you are now much more productive. Now you're able to accomplish more, and you are able to spend your time on things that you care about, the things that are important for you, and then leave all that busy work to your systems, to your automations.
There are so many vampires out there sucking energy and time and who knows what other things. But I really appreciate you curating those productivity and automation and prioritization tips, because it's just a beautiful thought for anybody to think of, like, like what would I do if I freed up, you know, a few more hours each day, or like if I didn't have to do this task that I hate anymore. Really, really appreciate you putting that together and putting that book out into the world. Let's prioritize our ending here and ask you the most important questions you've ever been at. No, I'm just kidding. Said differently, let's wrap up with some rapid fire Q&A. You ready for it?
Yeah, okay.
All right, let's get wild. We have something pretty cool in common. We've both spent some time in Connecticut. So we're Connecticutans of sorts. That just sounds weird. Connecticutans. I don't know what that is. That could be a pet shop. I don't know. But I lived in Stamford, or as they say, Stam Vegas, for a few years when I was starting my career in the corporate world. So fond memories of Connecticut. But I know you went to school at Bridgeport. It could be about Bridgeport or just Connecticut overall, but just first things that pop to your head, what is your favorite part of living in Connecticut and your least favorite part of your time there?
I will say the fall. I will say like the leaves, the New England in general. The fall time is incredibly beautiful. Like, and I also lived in Stamford for a while.
Shout out, Stam Vegas is very strong.
Yeah. Actually, the reservoir is kind of inside New York State, I believe. But still, I would consider it in Stamford. Like, it's so beautiful. I don't know if you went hiking there. It's such a beautiful place. And there are other beautiful hiking places with beautiful foliage. Yeah, that's the best part about it. The worst part is it's not New York City, right? So you are kind of, even if you live in Connecticut, all your weekends are actually in New York City. So you go to New York City over the weekend. So it's not New York, yeah. Which might be a good thing, but it's, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, I totally echo those. Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, when I came out for my interview for that job, the driver that took us from the airport was like, because, you know, me, shout out my friend Spence, who got the job as well. But neither of us had been to Connecticut before. And so we were asking the driver about Connecticut. He's like, Connecticut is a state within a forest. Like, it's just trees everywhere. It's beautiful. And yeah, all of, you know, upstate New York and New England is beautiful there. But yeah, I'm with you. As more and more time went on, I spent more and more weekends in the city visiting my friends and doing stuff in the city. And definitely those costs and the commuting time. Although, on the Metro North, you can drink, you can charge your phone. Like, it's not bad, but it's definitely not as easy as, you know, stepping out your apartment on 36th Street and you're in the city, you know. So that's really cool. Shout out Stamford, Stam Vegas. How about somewhere a little bit of a plane ride away? So, no, you're from Turkey originally. What is the most beautiful area of Turkey?
Obviously, Istanbul is like the historical heritage. All these like the Roman Empire and then the Ottoman Empire, just like all these amazing architecture and the Bosphorus, it's incredible. But this is kind of if you are coming to Turkey from outside, right? But as a person who lives in Turkey right now, it's definitely the Aegean Sea. It's so beautiful, like these turquoise waters, like these blue waters, beautiful, like, you know, flat sea, and just amazing. Yeah.
It sounds beautiful. And for my friends that have visited there, of course, a lot of them have gone for the where they do the hot air balloons.
Cappadocia.
Yes, exactly. I will not try to pronounce it. You got it. So, but everybody just seems to have the best time there. So that's really cool. And then you mentioned earlier that you've never been a risk taker. You're bad at poker. What is something that you're good at, like a game or, you know, just hobby, like something, just a hobby, something from your personal life that you're actually pretty good at?
I still play basketball a lot. Now I'm 46. But I'm still playing basketball. Right after this call, I'm actually going to a basketball, playing basketball.
Kudos to you for not jumping off half an hour ago. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we play basketball. We join leagues. We join all these tournaments. You know, last time we were in a 3x3 tournament, and we were actually in the semifinals. I still enjoy it. I'm old. I'm slow. Like these young guys are just. I cannot move as fast as them, but I still enjoy it. And, hopefully I will be able to continue doing it for a long time.
Well, I'll take your old and slow and say, no, you're young and fast. So next time I'm in the area, we'll have to have a pickup game. I miss playing basketball. I haven't played in too long. If you had a current or classic NBA player that you modeled your game after, who would that be?
Wow.
I'm not saying you're comparing yourself to this person, but who inspires you?
I cannot be as good as, of course, not like I can try to be like Michael Jordan, of course, but he's the idol. He's definitely the idol. After I watched the documentary, I became a bigger fan of Michael Jordan. I didn't know so much about him until he was my favorite, but I didn't know so much about him. I especially liked how he actually motivates himself by trying to find ways to get himself angry, like about the other person, like, you know, even though like the other person, like the competitor, didn't say something to him, like he imagines that person actually told him, like, you know, you suck or you're old or something like that. And then he actually motivates himself to become more explosive. And I think that's a great lesson for all of us, even for entrepreneurs, to just it's very important to motivate ourselves. Just find ways to motivate ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely legendary. I think you could take him one-on-one. You might be able to be. You never know. But clearly, like, the best, if not one of the best, like, killer instinct of all time, and just best at, like, motivating themselves and the clutch game-winning gene. You know, we could speak forever about Michael Jordan. I've never heard of him, actually. No. But last one. You mentioned throughout this interview some of the rules that you abide by and kind of set for yourself and your team as a business owner. Like, you talked about the 50-50 rule. You talked about your rule for hiring new employees. I'm curious, outside of work, like, is there a rule that you have for, like, you and your family around the house that you're pretty loyal to?
Now that I have three kids, I have a 9-year-old, 7-year-old, and now a 1-year-old.
Wow! Congrats! You got your hands full, as if the business wasn't enough.
There is no outside world. This is like there's work, and there's also kids for me. Kind of, actually, enjoy it. I enjoy it so much. Like, I don't miss anything else. Like, it's just so much fun. Like, the kids are so much fun. They take away my they take all my time, and I enjoy it so much. So it's about them now.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, a beautiful note to end on. Idakin, which I did pronounce, I did check the phonetic, my writing of your name again, but Idakin, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your stories, your tips, your rules, your basketball skills that are definitely better than Michael Jordan. I'll give it to you. Where is the best place for people? There's three parts here. For people to connect with you online, to try out JotForm, and to grab a copy of your book.
So my first name, last name.com, itakintank.com. I have a website where you can actually, you know, find my articles, you know, contact me. You can find my book and, you know, everything about me there. You know, the book is available on bookstores like Amazon and all the bookstores, Barnes & Noble. And I also write at Entrepreneur Magazine, Fast Company, so you can read more about the stuff I've been talking during this podcast. And I also really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, Max.
Of course, of course. Thank you so much. Likewise, back at you. And last thing, final thoughts. It could be just a quote, like one sentence, you know, words to live by or advice for entrepreneurs. Send us home here.
One of the things that I, you know, a quote that I have in the book is from Eisenhower. It's about prioritization. He says that I have two kinds of problems, the important and the urgent. And the urgent ones are never important. So make sure that you spend your time on the important things and leave the urgent ones to automation, delegation, find, you know, get rid of them, work on what's important for you.
And this interview had so many important takeaways. Again, I could not talk in so many ways. Thank you, Eideken, so much for coming on the podcast, sharing your incredible rules and stories and lessons. And thank you, Wild listeners, for tuning in to another episode. If you want to hear more wild stories like this one, make sure to follow the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and check us out on Good Pods. And if you're interested in the video version, check out YouTube at Max Brandstetter. There is some more and more and more and more video versions coming. And that's the second highest pitch my voice has gotten. For any help with podcast production, you can learn more at maxpodcasting.com, where I'm currently spending extra time editing out the extremely loud pile driver next door that is causing a ruckus. Thank you very much. I hope it's a beautiful building. And to sign up for the Podcasting to the Max newsletter, it is where podcasting meets entrepreneurship and awful puns. You can sign up at maxpodcasting.com/newsletter. That's short and sweet to your inbox every Thursday from moi. Until next time, let your business run wild.
Bring on the bongos!